If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Friday, September the 4th, and welcome back to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen. I'm a research fellow here at the Hoover Institution and the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. My guests today, plural, joining me from their respective hideouts somewhere in the vicinity of the Stanford University campus are David Brady and Doug Rivers. Dave Brady is a senior fellow here at the Hoover Institution and a longtime political scientist and lecturer at both Stanford University and Stanford's Graduate School of Business. Doug Rivers, likewise, is a Hoover Institution senior fellow and a Stanford University political scientist. He's also a pollster extraordinaire, chief scientist at YouGov PLC, a global polling firm. Gentlemen, welcome back to the show, The State of the Race, as we like to call it. Now, today marks 59 days until Election Day, and with the Labor Day weekend approaching, it's considered the beginning of the sprint to the election. The first debate's coming up on September the 29th in Cleveland. Gentlemen, ordinarily, in an ordinary election in which there would have been ordinary conventions, we'd be talking about convention bumps. The question, let's start with, did either party have a bump? Doug, you've been looking at your Economist YouGov numbers. Why don't you walk us through some of the findings of that?
Sure. We ran a poll right after the Republican convention where we recontacted people that we talked to at the end of August before either convention. That was a poll done for Yahoo News, and it showed that Biden's lead had dropped from around 9 points to about 6.5 as of the Friday afternoon after the Republican convention. Subsequent to that, we continued talking to more people, and Biden gained a bit. By the end of the weekend, that poll was at about 7.5 point lead for Biden, which was down slightly from what he was before. A couple other polls showed similar small bumps for Trump. But then the polls that came out this week, including our latest poll for The Economist that was released on Tuesday, had Biden with leads about the same as what he's had for a while. We were at 11, which is a little on the high end, but most were in the neighborhood of 8, 9, 10 points. So I think the right now, it looks like after the conventions, you still have Biden with a pretty healthy lead, probably not double digits would be the consensus, but much larger than what Hillary Clinton had coming out of the conventions in 2016.
So, Dave, it sounds like both parties had their conventions, and after the dust settled from the, well, to the extent dust can settle from virtual conventions, but once the two conventions were over, we pretty much were back to where we started before these conventions, right?
Yeah, I think the good news for Biden is that when you compare him to Clinton at the same time, Biden, among all Democrats, if you take Democrats with leaners, i.e. those people who say, I'm an independent, but I'm leaning Democrat, Biden's at 91% among them, with only about 4% saying they'll vote for, 3.5% saying they would vote for Trump. And that's interesting. By the way, there is, and this question is for Doug also, political science doesn't have very good turnout. We have a hard time knowing exactly who's going to turn out. And I did notice in the latest YouGov poll, there's one way you say, are you registered voters? That's the number I just gave you. But if you say, check that, another way to ask, how important is this vote to you? That's another way to look at it. And then there's an enthusiasm one. And you do get some differences on the, if you measure enthusiastic about the election by just people who are very serious and really serious about, they're enthusiastic, Trump comes closer onto that. He cuts it down to about 7-8 points. So I'm wondering, Doug, which of these measures, enthusiasm, registered to vote, how important is the vote? Which one do you use, and why?
So Traditionally, after Labor Day, we switch to likely voters versus registered voters.
Right.
It's generally thought that the survey measure of likelihood of voting isn't all that great to begin with, and it's really hard to ask outside of an election period. But this is the time at which people tend to focus on the election. In 2016, a likely voter screen typically helped Trump by 2, sometimes 3 points. People are waiting to see what it's going to look like this year.
But is likely voter vote the importance of the vote, enthusiastic? Are you both of them?
It's a question, will you definitely vote, probably vote, that sort of thing. Enthusiasm measure, I think, is measuring a different thing. No one doubts that Trump voters are enthusiastic about Trump, whereas the Biden voters tend to be, he's the lesser of two evils. You've got people on the left that would have preferred a more progressive candidate. You've got moderates in the suburbs that would prefer someone more centrist. Enthusiasm has been higher, measured in terms of enthusiasm about who wins the election, that sort of thing, has tended to be higher on the Republican side.
But by the way, on that very point, it is interesting that if you look at the liberals in the Democratic Party, whether they say they're very liberal or liberal, they say about 68 to 70% say they're voting against Trump. But the moderates in the Democratic Party, about half of them say they're voting for Biden.
Right.
So that is different from what happened with Mrs. Clinton in 2016.
Yeah, and Biden is perceived by independents and Democrats as being a moderate. The RNC tried to paint Biden as a radical, but he seems to respond fairly effectively, saying, do I look like a radical socialist? So I think that's going to be a tough sell for the Trump campaign, but they're trying.
He would seem to have a hard time chipping through on that. I'm going to give you some numbers, gentlemen, from a poll that Fox News put out earlier this week. Fox does something I think is clever. Their poll is done, actually, it's bipartisan. It's done by a group called Beacon Research, which is a Democratic outfit out of Boston, and also by a Republican group called Sean Company, which I think is your friend Darren Shaw, if I'm not mistaken. They looked at three states, Arizona, North Carolina, Wisconsin. Here's what they found. They found that Biden trails in North Carolina by 1 point, but he leads in Wisconsin by 5, leads in Arizona by 5. That's terrible news for Trump, obviously. But here's the point I'd like to raise. In Wisconsin, voters prefer Biden over Trump on the coronavirus by 17 points. Now, here's a surprise. On the issue of policing and criminal justice, Wisconsin voters favor Biden by 5. On issues such as the economy in China, Trump and Biden basically broke even. Half of Wisconsin voters, about 45% in this poll, Dave and Doug, feel the coronavirus is not at all under control. And that group picks Biden over Trump by an 84-10 margin. So here you have Trump getting pounded on the coronavirus issue, but also this would suggest that the criminal justice issue, the rioting, the policing issue, hasn't broken through in that state.
Yeah, the policing issue has moved a bit in the Republican direction. The ratings of Black Lives Matter have gone down a bit, but it's not enough to really bail Trump out of the coronavirus problem.
So I looked at that on the latest YouGov Economist poll, and it was interesting. They ask the question a little differently. They say, do you have confidence in Biden separately, and then do you have confidence in Trump or not, or are you worried about it? And interestingly, on confidence in Biden, 47, and this is without partisan, this is just the voter, registered voters, 47% said they had confidence in Biden, compared to 35% who said they had confidence in Trump on the coronavirus, and 42% unease on Biden, 57% unease. And on crime, which was really surprising, 48% said that they had confidence in Biden on crime, but only 39% said they had confidence on confidence in Trump on crime. So that those Wisconsin figures are showing up. And I guess most interestingly, the gap on the economy, who would do better under the economy? Biden's at 39 saying that the economy would get better, and Trump is only at 40 saying if he's elected. So Biden, those are all good things for Biden, but I was surprised by the crime.
Yeah, so we've tried some questions where we ask people, do you think the country is out of control? And, you know, close to 80% of the people think the country is out of control. And if so, do you think Donald Trump will bring it under control, or is he the cause of the chaos? By a fairly large margin, 46 to 27, people think Trump is the cause of the chaos, not the solution to it. We asked, you know, if Trump is elected, do you think there will be more violence or less violence? And by 52 to 23, that's quite a margin. People think there will be more violence if Trump is reelected. So while the crime issue is not nearly as good for Biden as coronavirus, right now, the crime issue is not working for Trump either.
Right, so he's not Richard Nixon in 1968 at this point. Gentlemen, let me ask you this question. If you watch Trump's acceptance speech, you'll notice that Kamala Harris was missing in action. She was not on the Democratic ticket, but he did talk about a ticket of Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. In other words, he invoked the idea that if you elect Joe Biden, he's a Trojan horse. I think that's the exact phrase he used for Biden, a Trojan horse for Bernie Sanders and democratic socialism. But is there anything in your polling data which shows that that's an effective approach for Trump? Are voters really dialed into the idea of the Bernie Sanders, the AOC agenda?
I don't see it yet. I mean, the Republicans were, they thought that anyway, but I saw no movement, and I started to check back through March when it looked like Trump would be most people thought he was a pretty sure winner then. I don't see it. Doug?
No, I mean, it is the case, and I'm sure their polling is showing this, which is Americans are not socialist. They're not in favor of Medicare for all. They're opposed to violence. But trying to associate Biden with Sanders so far has not convinced people that Biden is a socialist who wants to defund the police.
Well, I found it curious because Republicans for decades always employed the idea of a boogeyman. Ted Kennedy, for example, was always a convenient boogeyman. Don't elect them, Ted Kennedy will get his hands on control. And Ted Kennedy was just a very vivid image for Americans to grasp onto. But it seems to me that the Bernie AOC approach is not working for Trump. So again, are Americans really not just tuned into Sanders and AOC, or just do they not make the nexus between Biden and a hard shift to the left?
I think Biden's been there so long, and so many people know him, and he doesn't sound like a radical. It's hard to tell how much these speeches matter, but his speech Tuesday about we're going to make sure that, you know, if it's violent, you should pay the penalty for that. There's a difference between the two. I don't know. Maybe that's working some, but whatever it is, it has not caught on yet.
Well, Doug, I thought he had a clever line in that speech where he said, look at me. Do I look like that kind of guy? And, you know, here is where I think the age actually works to his advantage. Here is where the many chevrons on his sleeve from being in Washington for 50 years work. In other words, you can't make him a concoction of the crazy left if he has a long record to fall back on suggesting otherwise. So, again, it just puts the Trump campaign in a bind is how to paint this guy into a corner.
Well, and they're flailing. They're trying three different things, and none of them are really working at this point. They need more discipline on their message. You got to stick to one thing. It can't be that Biden is a socialist one minute, and a bit later is that he Kamala Harris was an evil prosecutor.
Yeah, I think the Wall Street Journal, Dan Hennings in there the other last week had a column, and there was a drum. And I think Trump's tweets and stuff work against him. They have both said in various ways that what Trump is doing works against getting that message out, making it harder for people to read it. You can't do what Doug just said and hope that message sticks. It's not going to stick unless you have the same message. By the way, one other thing on that, there's a question about whether people thought whether what was going on in Portland, et cetera, was peaceful or violent. Another reason it might not be working, Democrats say overwhelmingly it's peaceful, 72, only 14% of Democrats say it's any of it's violent, whereas Republicans are the opposite, 15% say they're peaceful and 72% say they're violent. So the bottom line is it's a partisan issue and it's not moving people.
Yeah, though that one is more in the Republicans' favor.
Yes.
If you ask people, is it more violent or more peaceful? You get about by 60-40 that it's more violent. So I think Biden would be hurt badly if he came out and said, the violence is due to is justified. I think his response where he said, I'm opposed to violence on the left and the right. I challenge Donald Trump to denounce violence by whoever causes it, was a pretty effective response.
So I agree. The other thing is, the interesting thing is independents they make it in this case, they break it, the independents by about 25 points think that the protests are more violent than they are peaceful. And by the way, the independents are breaking for Trump, not as much as they did for Hill, as they did in the last election, but he's still among pure independents. He has more votes than Biden.
Yeah, the data is a little variable on that. I mean,
yes,
we've seen some different numbers for independents depending on the sample. I've been trying to figure out what's going on there.
I agree with that. One thing that's interesting on this is when you have been tracking sort of the number of Democrats and Republicans, hasn't changed much. But if you look, you're getting about 50 in March to the present, you get about 51% who say they're either Democrats or lean Democrat. And among Republicans, they're about 38% with independents, just around 10.5 points.
All right. A question for the two of you. Is this an anti-Trump election, or is this an anti-Trump, anti-Republican election, or is it an anti-Trump, anti-incumbent election, or all of the above, or none of the above?
That's yours, Doug.
I don't know, Bill. I mean, it does look to me like the Republican Senate's going to...
Well, let me throw two numbers at you, Doug, going back to that Fox News poll. So they did Wisconsin, Arizona, North Carolina, and there are Senate races in North Carolina and Arizona. In the North Carolina race, Dave and Doug, they had Cal Cunningham. He's the Democratic challenger. They had him up on Tom Tillis, the Republican incumbent, by 8 points. In Arizona, where Martha McSally is the senator, she took over John McCain's seat. She's challenged by Mark Kelly, a Democrat. He's a NASA astronaut, married to Gabby Giffords. That race, gentlemen, hold on to your hats. That is a 56-39 race in favor of the Democrat.
So, yeah, I'll take the under on that one.
Yeah, but still, you have an 8-point race in North Carolina, 17 in Arizona. Even if we want to skew that back a few points, considering these are real red states to begin with, though they're in play this year, that still suggests, though, that there is down ticket trouble for Republicans.
Absolutely. The polls that have come out this week were strong for Biden, and at some level, they're even stronger down ballot for Democrats.
So well, when you say that, I mean, it's still, there's a ways to go, and they've got four seats to make up. So what's your
learned our lesson in 2016, which is don't get overconfident about what's going to happen.
Right. So what would your top bet? My top bet for the Democrats at this point would be they 50 or 51 seats in the Senate.
I'd agree with you on that. The
stop the podcast.
We're getting out of predicting, but
yeah,
write that down. 51.
Yeah. You know, the problem is that's everyone here is looking at, well, gee, the Biden's lead can narrow, the Democrats could do worse. Well, it also can go the other direction. And so there are another, you know, three or four Republican seats, which if it were a disastrous election, which I don't, you know, I mean, I don't see Georgia or Texas going Democratic, but those are competitive states at the moment, and they have competitive Senate races.
Right. But you know, the question though, again, is if there's an anti-Trump sentiment, does it also wash out Republicans? I'll check it. Let's take a state like Maine, for example, where Susan Collins is in the most difficult race of her life. She is a longtime Republican incumbent. She has done a pretty good job over the years of trying to distance herself from the more conservative aspects of Republican existence in Washington, but she has things to answer for, most notably voting for Brett Kavanaugh. So is it possible that we could see ticket splitting go here, where in a state like, you know, Maine, where Trump would lose statewide, maybe he'd pick up the second congressional district and get that one electoral vote, but he could lose the state overall, but she could slip by.
Possible, yes.
Well, she's going to do better in Maine than he is, but I think her race looks pretty bleak for her.
Right. Then conversely, you have a state like Colorado, let's say, where the Republican incumbent there, people tend to think is toast. The Arizona race, Martha McSally seems to be in trouble. So maybe Dave is right. Maybe looking at a 51 or a 50-50 Senate. But question, gentlemen, why doesn't this carry over into the House? If voters are in a bad mood, if they're upset about economic conditions, if they're upset about handling a COVID, why aren't they taking this out on Nancy Pelosi?
The congressional ballot for the House is +9 for the Democrats.
+9 for the Democrats.
Yeah, that's, you know, the Democrats had a strong year in the House in 2018. I think they'll do, I don't think they're going to give back those gains.
I agree.
Okay, but why +9? I mean, what has the Democratic House done that has earned the public's trust?
Oh, they aren't Donald Trump.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know about the, I don't know about the 9 number. But there just aren't, in this election, if you go down the list, there just aren't that many competitive seats. And just like you've got Republicans retiring in 2018, there's a little bit, some of that. And so I just, it's not a good year in the House for Republicans.
I mean, there are not that many competitive House seats up, so the swings are going to be more muted. There are places that Democrats won in 2018 that were right on the edge. So, you know, we know the California seats where Democrats pulled out nearly every close race and, you know, recently gave one of those back.
Interesting. Have you guys noticed anything interesting in data as it relates to mail-in voting? Have you done any sampling on the number of people who are going to mail-in vote? Do you have any sense that mail-in voting in any way is going to skew pre-campaign, pre-election polling?
So Trump was criticizing mail-in voting, and for a while we were seeing Republicans less likely to say they were going to vote that way. Seen some pickup now, and
So, John, you're asking that question in the polls. How are you going to vote?
Yeah. So, you know, we expect mail voting to be way up relative to 2016.
Do we get it? Do we have any sense that the mail-in voter is as enthusiastic as the walk-up voter?
I did not get any difference when I looked at, but I did not look at it carefully. And I will do so before the next one.
Okay, very good. And I'd like to turn your attention to the concept of the shy voter. This is a phrase that came up in political science in the 1990s, the coining of the phrase, the shy Tory factor. This was in relation to British elections where the conservative vote, the Tory vote, was undersampled, underpolled, and then on election day, they did better than poll suggested. You heard this phrase come up in 2016 with Trump, the idea of the shy Trump voters. If you go back and look at the data from 2016, I believe Trump outperformed his average in national polling by about 3 points on election day. Hillary beat her polling average by about 1.4 points. Do either of you buy into the notion of the shy Trump voter?
I don't. I've heard this for ages. There were turnout effects in 2016 of higher turnout, but we don't see any evidence that people were unwilling to tell us that they preferred Trump to Clinton.
I agree with Doug. I don't see it. You hear this all the time. But in terms of the polls, as you know, the YouGov Economist poll was very close to the actual total overall vote when it was finally all counted. So I just don't see it this time that people are afraid. Maybe that's because we are at Stanford, and maybe there are 10 votes here for him. But the people I know who are for him aren't shy about saying they're for him.
Well, exactly. So there's a group polling outfit called the Trafalgar Group. They're based in Atlanta, I believe. And Robert Cahaley is the head of that outfit. Trafalgar generally has very good Trump numbers because they go after what they call hidden voters. They, for example, have Trump up 1 point in Michigan. They have him ahead in Wisconsin by about a point. These were polls done last week. In the Michigan Senate race, they have John James, the Republican, ahead by 1.5%. I don't think you'll
find... He must have a lot of shy voters, too.
Well, exactly. But here's what Mr. Cahaley said about what he calls hidden voters. Quote, when we talk about hidden voters, what we're talking about is the social desirability bias. And that is when people basically tell a live caller what they think will get them judged least harshly. I can understand that somebody wanting to say that in terms of voting for Donald Trump, because you do know you're going to get into an argument if you say you support Trump. On the other hand, anecdotally, I've not met any shy Trump supporters in my life. They are defiantly, proudly supportive of Trump. So I kind of have a hard time with the idea of a pollster running into somebody on the other end of the line who's just kind of reluctant to say this.
We do the same thing in online polls where there is no person talking to them, and IVR where it's a machine-generated voice. There doesn't seem to be any variation by these things. So, what Trafalgar does is adjustments that they don't really explain exactly how they work, but get them estimates that are across the board more Republican.
Right.
Yeah, so I guess my view of that is if you thought about Michigan, if you said in Ann Arbor or in East Lansing where Michigan and Michigan State are, that maybe there were some shy voters, I would believe that. But the fact is, they're not dominating the polls, and I really do find it hard to believe that people want to believe there's all these secret Trump voters in Ann Arbor and East Lansing and Detroit that are going to turn the election over, because those are the spots where you would get an argument. You're on the upper peninsula in Michigan, you're not going to get an argument. That's going the other way.
Yeah. I would say, Bill, that Trump voters are less likely to participate in surveys. Right. And, you know, that may be a distrust. But the ones that participate in the surveys tell us that they're going to vote for them. They're not reluctant on that. And the way most online polls work is we ensure that we get the right fraction of 2016 Trump voters. So that lower levels of participation by Trump voters in the surveys isn't reflected in the outcomes that we report.
Right. By the way, on that point, Bill, it's interesting because the economist YouGov Doug does have Clinton people who voted for Clinton in 2016 and people who voted for Trump in 2016. And I did make that calculation. This time around, if you voted for Clinton in 2016, you're 92% for Biden, 3% for Trump. But if you voted for Trump in 2016, you are 88% for Trump, and 9% of those people are voting for Biden. So they're still, they have not, the Republicans have not, and the Trump campaign has not brought even all of his own voters back.
Right. So I guess one of the keys for Trump here is to find, if not a hidden vote, a sleeper vote, if you will. If you go back and look at the 2012 election, the Obama campaign was brilliant at finding votes that we didn't think existed. And I think the polls in that election underestimated him by something like 2 points. But yet he pulled out wins in places like Florida because they just turned out the votes in ways we didn't anticipate. And I guess that's going to be the secret to Trump's success or failure in this election, too, if he could just find supporters out there that the polls didn't find.
Yeah, so Obama in both 08 and 12 did turn out minority voters at much higher rates than normal, which added about a point to their vote. And then in 2018, the Democrats had quite a high turnout among younger voters relative to what you expect in a midterm. It's not clear that's going to get repeated this time, but that's an important source of vote. Having said that, the problem with turnout strategies is turning somebody from a non-voter to a voter adds half a vote, whereas getting someone to switch from, say, Obama to Trump adds a full point to the candidate's vote and 2 points to the lead.
Okay. So you guys look at these numbers. What does Donald Trump have to do to close this gap? What does he have to do differently? What can he try differently?
He's hoping for a vaccine in October.
I think if there's a vaccine in October, I think that would be a help. They've been pushing for that. I do think if the protests in Portland and other places were to continue or get worse, and who knows what event might set that off, and the president could hone in on that and not say at one point Kamala Harris was too severe as a prosecutor, and then turn around the other day, if they could stick on message, that's one message that might do it. And I think the other one is they have to keep pressing on. I think the campaign issues are right. I think they just haven't stuck to them, i.e. Biden's going to go be too far left. He's going to be bad for the economy. But thus far, those messages have not been on target.
Well, the economy is the best thing for him, but it's not as advantageous to him as it was, 6 months ago when it was a big gap. And
exactly.
I think their solution to their campaign problem is like their solution to the coronavirus problem, which is to hope for coronavirus going away and the economy coming roaring back, and to pretend that all the last 6 months never happened. That's not exactly the kind of strategy I'd bank on.
Okay, let me throw one other thing at you. That debate on September the 29th in Cleveland, I think, somewhere in Ohio. I don't think they have a location mapped out yet. But Joe Biden has a very shaky performance. Is there anything in the polling data which suggests that voters were at all paying attention to age or mental acuity or anything like that? My guess is there's probably not, because he hasn't been that visible for the past 5 months.
Well, Republicans, particularly Trump supporters, do buy into the mental acuity argument.
Right.
It hasn't, I think Biden has had reasonably good performances lately, and hasn't had to campaign too much. So there've been few gaffes and pretty strong TV performances. A bad performance in a debate could cause him problems, but I don't think there are that many persuadable voters in this election. To expect some event to come in and just radically change the contest, that seems unlikely to me.
And Dave, it would have to be bad performances, plural, wouldn't it? Look, Ronald Reagan had a miserable debate performance in 1984. He bounced back. Barack Obama had a terrible debate performance in his first against Mitt Romney in 2012, and he bounced back. So I think with Biden, it would have to be repeated blows, just repeated bad performances that maybe would start the ball rolling on uncertainty about him.
I agree with that. It would take that, but it depends. I think that the audience for this first debate is going to be immense, because if you stop to ask yourself, what do you think it'll be like? I actually don't have any idea. I can imagine it going okay, but I can also imagine it really blowing up.
Yeah. And you're having less, fewer campaign rallies, less of the usual campaign stuff. So the debates are going to be bigger this year than they have been in past years.
Will there be, there's going to be no audience for them, or we don't know that yet?
I don't think there's going to be an audience, but I'll have to check on that.
That's what I thought too, but
yeah.
I think that'll help Biden.
Well, I think it's a good idea generally. The audiences are...
The audience disrupts, it gets in the way.
Distraction. And the next thing is take the journalists off of the...
Okay. Are you two volunteering for this?
No. No. I volunteered Doug for it, or you. My view is they're not going to take those people away.
Yep.
No, that's not going to happen. But I think the audience is a distraction. And I think journalists posing questions of when did you stop beating your wife and so forth is not helpful.
But you don't think we could go back to, if you've ever gone back and looked at those Kennedy Nixon debates, they were models of civility. We're not going to go back to these old gentlemen sitting around having discussions about what they disagree about. You're not going to that.
Well, Kennedy Nixon was reasonably good TV, but yes. I don't believe Jim Lehrer is available to moderate the debates.
No, that's a good point. You know, Doug, you touched on something interesting in that, Biden has been pretty good in his public appearances. They've done a good job of kind of controlling things. The flap here in California the other day with Nancy Pelosi and her visit to the hair salon.
Haircut.
A blowout, actually. Just like you get, Dave.
Yeah.
And, what struck me about that, well, besides obviously just the gift that is Nancy Pelosi when it comes to these things, remember the incident where she was standing in front of the Sub-Zero fridge with the, you know, with the $12 a pint ice cream. Just she doesn't always get the images this right. But what kind of struck me about that gentleman was that, you know, here's a real kind of blunder, something that just kind of blew up on her and just can really kind of throw a campaign in confusion for a few days. But because Biden is so carefully controlled right now, because he does have the ability to stay off the, you know, off the campaign trail, he's not making these unforced errors. And that would seem to me to kind of keep this electorate just more set in place.
Well, that certainly helped him over the summer. He started to come out, and he must do that. I don't think he can run a front porch campaign
but the idea is I trail this guy by 7 points, and I can try like heck to kind of drum my base up and try to, you know, get some independents to come over. But this guy's got to screw up. He's got to help me here.
Yes.
And he's just not coming out that much and doing very many things and not taking questions from the press. He's doing his best to play error-free ball.
And doing a pretty good job of it.
And I think the continuation of the virus is going to continue to help. He has to get out a little bit, but if he gets out like he did in Kenosha and he did in Pittsburgh, that's not really getting out. Those were both very controlled events. No real chance for him to blow it, I think. And I think the coronavirus, the fact that it's there and you got masks, and you can do that, I think that that's going to help him all the way through avoid mistakes.
Yeah, and I think that's the kind of event they're going to do for the next 2 months. Unless they're, this race tightens a whole lot, there's very little incentive for him to do excessive numbers of appearances. The whole point of the campaign is national TV.
Right. Well, they went through a little panic period last week where I guess they saw some tightening polls or they saw the crime issue gaining ground. And remember, Biden was not going to come out and do anything publicly until after Labor Day weekend. Then all of a sudden he's giving a speech in Western Pennsylvania. Then he's off to Kenosha, Wisconsin to meet the Blakes. And so they did change on the fly for that. So they have some polling data we haven't seen.
Well, I think he looks weak if Trump does something and he doesn't respond at all.
Right.
Trump went to Kenosha and Biden, I think, didn't want to do it, but they pretty much had to match Trump on that, I think.
Yeah, in regard to that, I think the interesting point is Biden was supposed to be caught in his party between the far left and if he tried to be too moderate. But at this point, if you look at Democrats who self-identify as very liberal or liberal, they are 95% voting for Biden, and overwhelmingly the reason they're voting for him is they're voting for him because they're voting against Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And so Biden has thus far managed that split in the party very well. A large number of moderates in the Democratic Party say they're voting because they like Biden, and the left is voting against Trump. And if he can keep that, with the Democrats having the lead they do, that's tough to win against.
Well, you know, here again, Joe Biden is a very, very blessed candidate. He did not have to have an ordinary convention where there could have been,
bats on the floor. Bernie's people could have walked out as they did in 2016. You know, no division on display there. Even AOC. AOC did not make much of a ruckus, even though she was given, what, 2 minutes, I think, to speak. John Kasich got more time at the Democratic convention than she did. But the far left had a pretty good week last week in Massachusetts, of all places, where the least likely of far left people you think of, 74-year-old incumbent Senator Ed Markey, knocked off Joe Kennedy III in a Senate primary. And this became kind of a proxy fight because, for reasons I don't quite understand, Nancy Pelosi decided to endorse Kennedy right before the primary, even though she didn't look at the polls, I guess, which showed Markey pulling away, and he won that primary, I think, by about 11 points. But what do you guys read out of Massachusetts besides just the obvious symbolism of a Kennedy losing for the first time in a Massachusetts race?
Markey's a popular guy. You would expect the Kennedy vote to Kennedy, a young guy, attractive young guy like that, to be able to pull young people. But amazingly, Markey and AOC, the young vote, as far as I can tell in the first run of results, that he got the youth vote, which is pretty surprising to me.
Right. You did you teach Joe Kennedy, by the way?
I did.
Mm-hmm. I thought so.
He's actually a very nice, I advised a summer project he did in refugee camps, and they built soccer fields so that at the end of their 2 summers, 90% of the people in these 2 refugee camps were actually playing soccer. He's a very nice young man.
Doug, there's your Markey Oppo hit, friend of Dave Brady.
Yeah, that's probably what cost him.
I mean, I think the Democrats could use someone in his age category.
Yes, they could.
It's a problem for the Democrats nationally that they've got a bunch of people in their late 70s leading the party.
And that was part of the Pelosi message, that she talked about Kennedy being the future of the party. But maybe she's 80 years old. Maybe she's not best directed to talk about the future of the party. But I don't know. Am I reading too much out of the fact that this was a proxy fight between her and AOC, and AOC won handily?
Well, I think Markey outflanked him. I mean, early on, Kennedy was up substantially in the polls. But with the coronavirus and everything, you didn't get a traditional kind of campaign there.
Okay. I'm curious, we haven't seen too many of these on the Republican side, though, in 2020, have we, where primaries become battles between Trump and anti-Trump people?
There aren't any anti-Trump people left in the Republican Party.
Well, and this is what's interesting, because the Republican National Convention, what was the platform? There was no new platform.
First time ever.
2016 platform just put in as a placeholder. So what do you guys think that says about the current Republican Party?
It's an amazing story of a complete takeover by Trump. The number of Trumps that were speaking at the convention in fairly long speaking parts was incredible. And that coupled with the lack of a platform shows you that it's the Trump party now.
Right. Dave?
I find it hard to disagree with that. There were a set of, say, 100 Republicans who signed a thing saying they wouldn't support Trump. They were voting for Biden, but a very small number. And people like George Will and Crystal, and those guys never Trumpers, you just don't hear anything about them within the party. Now, if Trump loses, we'll see what happens then. But at this point, it's his party.
If he loses, I think it's like the kids' game 52-card pickup, right?
Yes, it is.
Things on the floor. Okay, final question for you, gentlemen. As we look at the state of this race, Doug, if you're drawing up a battleground poll, how many states are you putting in for battlegrounds right now? Expand the definition of battleground, not just the purely obvious ones like the big three in the upper Midwest, Georgia, yeah. Texas, states like that. How far would you spread it?
Well, so states like Texas and Georgia are competitive, but I don't think most people put them in the battleground category. States that we thought were out of reach for Democrats, like Ohio and Iowa, are in the kind of stretch category. There aren't, on the Republican side, I think the Trump campaign bought some advertising in Minnesota, suggesting that they think Minnesota is close.
Right.
But and New Hampshire is the other one, but there aren't a lot of ones that look like they're possible pickups for Trump over 2016. And there are quite a few, you know, places. Not well, right now, Biden has a good lead in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. He's got a pretty reasonable lead in Florida, small lead in North Carolina, bigger lead in Arizona.
Right.
Those are all must-win states for Trump.
They are. Pennsylvania, I find fascinating because it's 20 electoral votes. It's a twofer, if you will, because that 20 equals Wisconsin and, well, it's one less than Wisconsin and Arizona, which is 21 combined. If Trump wins Pennsylvania, then it's hard to see Biden winning the election. If Trump loses Pennsylvania, it's hard to see Trump winning the election. In other words, that 20 is going to be a big hole for either candidate to make up.
Yeah, and the polling was pretty bad in Pennsylvania last time. That is one state where Trump's vote was understated. We were trying to figure out what was going on because early on we showed Trump doing so much better than other polls there. This time around, it's not a lot of polling showing Trump winning Pennsylvania.
Right. And Dave, it's notable that the two places Biden has gone have been Western Pennsylvania, where he gave a talk and said he will not do away with fracking, and on to Wisconsin. So you haven't seen him mucking around at Arizona or Texas or Georgia, you know, the more ambitious pickup states.
I agree with Doug that Minnesota is a state the Republicans could pick up. But at this point, given the numbers the way they are, Iowa and Ohio are possible for Biden to win.
But, you know, Trump, if he's going to spend his time in places that he absolutely has to win, you know, Georgia is not going to be like the tipping point state for Trump.
Right.
Neither is Texas.
Or Ohio.
He should be in Florida.
So they have to hope that whatever happens nationally picks them up in places where they should win relatively easily. So they can concentrate on places like Florida and Pennsylvania.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, final question. Is there anything that could kind of change this dynamic in the next few weeks, or do we have to just stay tuned and wait for the debates to happen until there could possibly be a change in this dynamic?
Well, you could have a shooting somewhere, riots expanding. That's something that we don't have control of. And given that people are inside from the pandemic, these things are more likely. So
but the pandemic goes on, the rioting goes on. I'm just kind of wondering what you could throw into this to kind of shake up this equation.
Oh, what you could throw in. I don't see anything till the debate.
Mm-hmm. My crystal ball is too cloudy.
Okay, guys. So we feel good about polling right now in 2020. We feel better about polling in 2020 versus 2016.
Well, we have no idea what's, you know, how the election is going to play out in terms of turnout, mail voting, the outcome being contested. Those are things that, you know, are impossible to predict. I would say the polling at the moment is looking pretty consistent. There isn't a huge gap between online and telephone polls. You know, even Rasmussen has, you know, Trump down. So it's a pretty consistent picture at this point.
And the thing that we don't really, in terms of the turnout, we also, in terms of the ballot counting, how many mails, the different states, and there's some legal issues there. And we may have more on that because next week we're meeting with Ed Foley, who is at Ohio State University, who's one of the experts on all the legal issues associated with the ballots and the counting of them and the Electoral College. So we may actually know something about that.
I think this is a fascinating topic. I did a podcast with our colleague, John Yu, earlier this week because he actually saw a scenario the other day. I think it was a pollster who suggested that Trump could actually be ahead on Election Day, but as mail ballots come in, Biden will take the lead.
That's the blue tide over time. But that's Yeah, because if you look at 2016 in terms of the number of votes, on the 2016 on election eve, Trump was doing better than he did at the end. Right. But it's clear that counting the ballots in California, New York, and states like that were what determined it.
Then you have a question if they can count their votes and certify them by mid-December, because the Electoral College meets on, I think, the 14th under the Constitution. Yeah. It meets on the Monday after the second Wednesday in December. So that would be the 14th. So that gives them a month and 11 days to get their act together.
Good luck.
Right. Not including lawsuits and both campaigns barely, you know, charging vote fraud or undercounts or what have you on the way. So, boy.
Well, it keeps us employed.
Well, I'm surprised this hasn't become a bigger issue. That you would have thought the norm is a presidential candidate has to say he will respect the outcome of the election, that he wants as many people as possible to vote, even if they don't really. The latest is Trump suggesting that his voters vote twice.
That's the problem here. Both sides have kind of danced around this in very hyperbolic ways. There's Trump, whether he was serious or not the other day, saying, I think it was North Carolina, you should vote twice. I think he had Al Gore, remember him, Al Gore? Al Gore saying that basically the military will be on call on inaugural day to pull Trump out of office if need be. So we have these.
I do want to point out to Doug that since May of 2015, this isn't the first time we've been astounded by what works and what doesn't work in American politics.
So much for expertise.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, maybe so this is the interesting polling to be done, just your confidence in the democratic system.
So we've done a bit of that. So we asked people whether they thought the election would be fair and whether they would accept the result. And there's a... most Democrats think that the election will be fair and say they would accept the result if Biden lost. But about 40% of Republicans say they would not, quote, accept the result, whatever that means.
Well, Dave, that's interesting because you've had, Hillary Clinton and others basically suggesting that Trump stole the election in 2016, that democracy was not served properly. So maybe that's encouraging. Maybe that tells us that the regular voters out there just don't listen to what the chattering class has to say.
Well, I think they do say that. But if you look at trust in institutions and the system, I think all of this takes a toll and reduces the level of trust in the national government.
Okay. Well, I'm going to trust the two of you to want to come back and do a podcast with me sometime after the first debate. How's that? Okay, sounds good. Dave Brady, Doug Rivers, thanks again for the conversation. See you in a few weeks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. In this podcast, what avenue the President may have, a narrow lane to re-election. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us. Get your friends to have a listen. You can find the Hoover Institution online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover's fellows. That includes Dave Brady and Doug Rivers straight to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @Hoover INST. Doug Rivers is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @Doug_Rivers, all spelled as you might expect, @Doug_Rivers. And his fine polling operation, YouGov, they're on Twitter @YouGov. That's spelled YOUGOV, YouGov, what the world thinks. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. On behalf of my colleagues here at the Hoover Institution, stay safe and stay healthy. And we'll do our best here at the Hoover Institution to help you stay informed. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.